episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Classified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. Images from the war in Ukraine have dominated the headlines over the last few weeks. But the Jewish identity of Ukraine's President Zelensky has been used by many in the West to cover NATO's clear alliance with neo-Nazi battalions in the war against Russia. But it's not just NATO that's working with these neo-Nazi groups in Ukraine. Israel is arming, and its military personnel are even fighting alongside explicitly neo-Nazi units. To find out more, I'll be speaking to a couple of experts after this report from Bianca Rahimi.
As the battle for Ukraine rages, we ask about the involvement of the Zionist regime in the conflict and any affinities between neo-Nazi currents in the Ukrainian military and the racist ideas inherent in the Zionist movement. The Zionist regime has supplied arms to the Ukraine military, including the Nazi Azov Battalion. Azov Battalion members have been photographed toting Tivor rifles built by Israeli Military Industries, a subsidiary of Elbit Systems. In 2018, it was revealed that a Ukrainian military training school website indicates that training is provided by former Israeli Defense Force officers. Israelis have been confirmed as joining the fight against Russia, and Ukrainian Zionists from the extremist Chabad-Lubavitch sect have also signed up with the Ukraine military. The neo-Nazi Azov battalion reportedly included a number of Jewish recruits. But the connections with Zionism go much deeper. Numerous prominent Zionists hailed from the Ukraine, including two former chiefs of the Israel Defense Forces and five presidents or prime ministers of the Zionist entity. Odessa in southern Ukraine has been referred to as the Gates of Zion. For example, the revisionist Zionist leader Vladimir Jabotinsky hailed from Odessa. Jabotinsky historically supported the Ukrainian nationalists, including their leader Simon Petliura. Zionist sources today credit Petliura with responsibility for the deaths of 50,000 Jews in the pogroms in the 1920s. But Jabotinsky maintained that Petliura was not an anti-Semite, even going so far as to state, "When I die, you can write on my grave, this was the person who signed an agreement with Petliura." Following the Western-sponsored coup in Ukraine in 2014, a school was named after Jabotinsky in Odessa in 2016. The Ukrainian nationalists under Stepan Bandera collaborated with the Nazis in the 1939 to 1945 war. Today he is revered by the Ukrainian far right. The openly Nazi Azov Battalion has now been incorporated into the Ukrainian armed forces. Much has been made of the fact that the president of the Ukraine, Zelensky, is Jewish, with the implication that he would not collaborate with Nazis. In fact, Zelensky is the protege of a powerful Ukrainian oligarch, Igor Kolomoisky. Kolomoisky, who has both Ukrainian and Israeli citizenship, owned Privat Bank, a company from which he is accused of looting more than $5 billion. Zelensky was the beneficiary of a network of shell companies set up to send cash from Kolomoisky offshore. Kolomoisky set up his own militia in 2014 and also funded the neo-Nazi Azov Battalion. Zelensky has ceded power to the far right in Ukraine and now depends on them as frontline fighters. On March 1st, Zelensky again showed the practical alliance with the far right by appointing Colonel Maxim Marchinka as the new governor of Odessa. Marchinka was the commander of the neo-Nazi Adar Brigade, accused of Daesh-style war crimes in 2014. the Zionist regime and its supporters are intimately involved in Ukraine. Both historically and now, the Zionist movement is allied with the Ukrainian far right.
We're joined today by the British-Iraqi hip-hop artist and activist who's a patron of the Stop the War Coalition. Loki's also the host of the Watchdog podcast on Mint Press, which investigates secretive organisations and powerful vested interests. We'll hear from Loki in a moment. Our resident expert, David Miller, will also be giving us the benefit of his insights. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading scholarly critic of Israel. He co-founded and is a co-director of the lobbying watchdog initiative Spinwatch. Welcome to the show. Loki, I'm going to start with you. Can you tell us what's the relationship between Zelensky and the far right?
Well, essentially, Zelensky has overseen the integration into the Ukrainian state of several explicitly neo-Nazi movements. He awarded towards the end of the last year the Hero of Ukraine Award to one of the main fighters from the right sector organization, which is one of the Banderite organizations. In addition to that, he appointed as advisor to Commander-in-Chief of the Ukrainian Armed Forces, Dmitry Yurosh, another very visible fighter from the right sector. As was mentioned, he has appointed as the governor of Odessa, one of the Ida battalion. And overall, what we see here is a push to really put the Ukrainian state at the need of these major neo-Nazi groups.
Interesting, yeah. I mean, David, people talk about the fog of war, don't they? And an example of this is that Ukraine can't possibly have a problem with Nazis because the president's Jewish. What do you say to that?
I would say, you know, let's look back at his inaugural speech when he became president. And in there, in the official translation on the government website, he talks about Ukraine becoming like Israel and defending its native land. Now, of course, that's a very strongly Zionist thing to say, but it also points out the strong confluence there is between Zionist ideas and Ukrainian nationalist ideas. These are far-right ideas which depend on an ethno-conception of the state. And of course, these work very well with the far-right. So Zelensky himself, yes, he's Jewish. He's also, you know, strongly oriented towards Israel, but that in itself is a sign of being oriented really towards the far right. And the evidence all, as Loki's just been saying, is that he has moved towards the far right. He's tried politically to distance himself from them, but in practice he depends on them as frontline fighters.
Right. Loki, I mean, I wonder whether you could explain for our viewers what the relationship is between Zelensky and this oligarch, Igor Kolomoyskyi.
Well, Igor Kolomoyskyi, a triple citizen, even though it's illegal in Ukrainian law, of Ukraine, Cyprus, and the Israeli regime. He's also a citizen of that entity. Now, he was the backer of the TV shows, which Zelensky was a major star of, and he was able to take him from being that star to his landslide victory in the presidential election of 2019. He was the top funder of Zelensky. Now, what's interesting is in addition to funding Zelensky, Igor Kolomoyskyi funded the Azov battalion and the Idar battalion as well at the same time, essentially. The period of thrusting Zelensky in front of the masses on TV, Kolomoyskyi was also funding these explicitly right-wing and neo-Nazi groups.
Interesting. I mean, David, I mean, there's a lot of people on the left are saying word to the effect that, look, there's Nazis everywhere, so we shouldn't get hung up with a few Nazis in Ukraine. I mean, how do you respond to that?
Well, I've heard people say that. I've heard them say, look, the Nazis in Spain are doing well in the elections. Certainly there's Nazis in Russia, and there are Nazis in this country too, but none of them are in government. None of them are in prime positions in the military, in the police. The Azov Brigade's street army is deployed alongside the national police across the Ukraine. This is an army of thugs, which is there to intimidate anyone who steps out of line. And that means, of course, people who are seen to be Russian or pro-Russian. It probably also means, and it has been in terms of their ideology, Jews too. Although, of course, there are some Zionists who are fighting on the other side.
Interesting, yeah. And, Loki, is there a precedent for NATO, or even Israel for that matter, associating so closely with neo-Nazis? I mean, it seems extraordinary.
Well, I think the key point that was mentioned in the clip that you showed was about Vladimir Jabotinsky. This is not some minor fringe figure within the Zionist movement. There is no other figure in Zionist history who has more streets, more hotels, more cinemas, more parks, more schools named after them within occupied Palestine 48 than Vladimir Jabotinsky. Now, his followers went on to be the Stern Gang, the well-known terrorist organization that targeted British soldiers and Palestinians, of course, more. Well, in 1941, and this is historical fact, the Stern Gang wrote a letter to the Nazi government of Germany offering to enter the war on the Nazi side and supporting the Madagascar plan. There is a long history of this intertwining of the idea, as Theodore Herzl put it, that the anti-Semites of Europe will be the best friends of the Zionist movement because they will provide the Zionist movement with the human material through which the state can be built. It doesn't matter how people feel about it. These are historical facts about how we came to be where we are today.
Sure. That's really interesting. Fascinating insight, Loki. And I wonder as well, the question I'd just like to ask you is, what do you think explains why Israel's arming the Azov battalion with these Teva rifles? I mean, is it facing any kind of pushback for that?
Well, when you look at the general NATO policy of pumping Ukraine full of weapons since 2014, there, you know, Poroshenko, the coup, the president after the coup, the US-backed coup, said publicly on TV he thanked the Swedes, the British and the Americans for sending the weapons. NATO nations were generally pumping this area full of weapons in order to draw the Russian state into a quagmire. So when the Israeli regime sends the Tavor rifles to Azov, they are merely part of this general push which is taking place.
Yeah, it's certainly a tangled web. And, well, thanks very much indeed, both of you, for that. But we'll come back for a further discussion shortly.
They gathered from all corners.
Chabad Lubavitch is an ultra-Orthodox Jewish sect with more than 10,000 emissaries in 100 countries worldwide. There are 52 centers in Ukraine and around 150 emissaries. Chabad is a dominant force in the Jewish community in Ukraine. Dnipro, Ukraine is the home to the largest Chabad, indeed the largest Jewish center in the world. Its benefactor was Ukrainian oligarch Igor Kolomoisky. But what is Chabad Lubavitch? Founded in the small Russian town of Lyubaveki near the border with Belarus, it is a messianic sect which believes Jews are the chosen people. According to Haaretz, Chabad's key religious texts state that non-Jews have only animal souls, not human souls. It runs a children's group called the Army of Hashem, which in the words of the leader of the sect, the Rebbe who died in 1994, is dedicated to waging war against non-Judaism. The supremacism of Chabad is nowhere more evident and pointed than in its activities in Palestine. A book called The King's Torah, written by two Chabadi rabbis from the notorious Yitzhar illegal settlement, justifies the killing of Palestinian children. It's not just words either. Chabad Lubavitch is heavily involved in the furthest extremes of the settler movement in Palestine. Chabad Lubavitch opposes returning any land at all to Palestinians, and according to the Zionist intelligence agency, Shin Bet, almost all price tag revenge attacks on Palestinians are carried out by followers of the sect. Chabad has links with the movement of the extremist Rabbi Meir Kahan, whose organization, the Jewish Defense League, was designated as a terrorist organization by the FBI. Chabad was reportedly implicated in funneling money from the US to Israel for Kahani. Today, it is deeply implicated in alleged fraud and embezzlement by Ukrainian oligarch Igor Kolomoisky. The Department of Justice has filed four separate actions against Kolomoisky, who is banned from entering the US. two Chabad leaders are specifically named in the charges. Given this history, it's no surprise that Chabad Lubavitch is integral to the events in Ukraine and is aligned with a far-right Ukrainian nationalist.
David, what can you tell us about this mysterious Chabad Lubavitch sect and what's its role in the Zionist movement?
It performs a very interesting role. They have this thing called shluchim, which is a word for emissaries, and they send emissaries all around the world. They have 10,000 of them, they say, in 100 countries. And the role of the shluchim is to encourage people to return to Jewish religious practice and to return to certain forms of Orthodox practice. And it's used as a way of bringing people into to Zionism by encouraging religious observance, even for non-Orthodox Jews. In a way, it's a funny thing because they don't really regard reform and liberal and progressive Jews as being real Jews. And it's an extraordinary sort of thing, but it's used to proselytize for the Zionist movement as well as for Orthodox Judaism. And it's, of course, leaned on by the Zionist movement more properly known. The Jewish Agency, for example, has adopted the same term, shluchim, for its emissaries, and it sends emissaries from Israel all across Britain and all across many other Western countries. And so it's used as a kind of cutting edge for expanding the influence of Zionism, even although it appears simply to be a religious organization.
Interesting. I mean, even the infamous Zionist intelligence agency, Shin Bet, seems sceptical about Chabad Lubavitch. I mean, why do you think its role in revenge attacks on Palestinians isn't better known? I mean, people need to be aware about this.
It's a truly extraordinary story, isn't it? These are people who are involved in daily attacks and humiliations of Palestinians. It's well known in Palestine that this is the case. The Zionist press regularly talks about it, and many of the things in the report you've just seen, the quotes come from Zionist press articles. But outside of Palestine, it's regarded as being a sort of cuddly and interesting Jewish local organization which will bring you in for a Shabbat supper and will be nice to local Jews and indeed to non-Jews. Mm. But actually, you know, when you look a little bit deeper, the theology underlying this, you saw that in the clip just there, the idea of a war against non-Judaism. It's a little bit frightening when people begin to think of that, how that might relate to the attacks on Palestinians, but also how that might relate to the views of this organization in terms of people in this country. So it's extremely surprising, really, when you see this, that hardly anybody in this country has any idea that this is the kind of organization it is.
Well, hopefully what we're doing today will have illuminated a few more people. But look, I mean, the FBI's banned the Ukrainian oligarch Kolomoyskyi and his family from the US and named two senior Chabad leaders as being intimately involved in his alleged looting and fraud in the United States. But how does that relate, do you think, to the conflict in Ukraine?
Well, the money, over $5 billion, it's said, was looted by Kolomoyskyi from a bank. This is only from the bank we're talking about. And it was done by a network of shell companies, which President Zelensky also benefited from. But these two guys, the Chabad guys in Florida, who've taken millions and millions of dollars, spread it around real estate and spread it around Chabadi charities in New York and indeed in Florida. This has been a means to get the money out of Ukraine. So it's been a means which has contributed to the destabilization of Ukraine. So that's one way in which it has contributed. But it's also contributed in the sense that Kolomoyskyi is absolutely central to the encouragement of the neo-Nazis and the pursuit of the power of President Zelensky. So there's a very strong connection here between the Chabad movement, which of course is supported in the Ukraine by Kolomoyskyi, and the whole neo-Nazi question. So these are very closely connected, and you know, truly extraordinary as a picture of what's happening in Ukraine now.
Absolutely. I mean, Loki, I wonder whether you could sum up for us how you think this Kolomoyskyi network relates to NATO's activities in Ukraine.
Well, essentially, since 2008, at least, at the Bucharest summit, you had NATO put very clearly in their conclusions that Ukraine would join the alliance. This is black and white and available on the NATO website, when you look at this funneling of money into building up what would become the bulwark of the Ukrainian state against Russia, then you see quite clearly how Kolomoisky and NATO's interests have intertwined. It's also important to point out that historically it's been said that if we were to list every single former Nazi that worked with NATO, that was sort of subsumed into NATO following World War II, it would take something like 3,000 pages. For example, you look at Sidney Gottlieb and his innovative work in terms of torture and developing MK Ultra. It took place with a team of Nazi doctors and scientists. There's so many other examples of the way in which US policy has integrated into it Nazi figures. So really, this is not a historical aberration at all.
No, indeed. I mean, what do you think the end game is here, though? I mean, this is a...
What it seems to me...
We're on the precipice, aren't we, potentially of a third world war here. I mean, so, you know, what on earth is going on?
Well, you have a few contradictions happening. On one hand, if the United States has separated Russia off from Europe, essentially, meaning that US companies will benefit massively from now being the source of gas for Europe. They have sidelined the Nord Stream pipeline, which was a major objective of US companies, no doubt. But then also, in addition to that, they seek in the long term to, through these sanctions, bring down the Russian government and either balkanize Russia or potentially, it's been said in recent days, integrate Russia into NATO itself. The other side, which may harm US interests, is of course when you push something like 3 billion people in Russia, India and China towards each other to trade in currencies other than dollars, what you have is quite serious ramifications economically for the United States. So it's quite a short-sighted policy, I would say.
I mean, those economic ramifications, David, I mean, they're also going to be felt potentially very acutely in Europe, aren't they? How have the political leaders taken leave of their senses? I mean, they're imposing these sanctions, but I've seen various commentators say that these are going to blow back on European citizens, on British citizens, with higher energy prices, higher food prices, and potential shortages of both. I mean, is the truth of that? What do you think?
That's right. I mean, it will blow back. It will blow back in that sense, in the economic sense. It will lead to hardship in this country. Fuel prices will increase, and that will be a significant effect. There will be blowback in terms of the neo-Nazis, of people who've gone to fight there, who come back to this country and will commit to attacks, like has been the case in the past, where the Ukrainian terrorists in this country have killed people, including, for example, the well-known campaigner Mas Salim. Her father was killed by a Ukrainian neo-Nazi. But also, I think the other question, which Karim touched on, is that this is about the possibility of ending a unipolar world. You push those people together, maybe they'll be joined by Venezuela, Iran, by Bolivia, by Cuba, and then you've got the beginnings of the end of the US empire. Once the SWIFT payment system, which has now been stopped in Russia, Russia's excluded from that, they will have to develop alternatives, alternative internet if they're censored, and that's going to lead potentially to the possibility of an emerging alternative power base which will challenge the US empire much more pointedly than this conflict has.
I mean, briefly, Loki, what do you think the future is then for the petrodollar as a result of this?
Well, I think it's inevitable that you will see major, major ramifications depending on what happens in Ukraine. I think that if you were right now sitting in the United States, what you would want was to increase this period of time. You know, Hillary Clinton actually put it this way: we are looking at the Afghanistan model. And when she means the Afghanistan model, she's talking about 1979, when the United States were able to draw the Soviet Union into occupation of Afghanistan. So really, they are working for a long-term goal, which I think will be hard for them to achieve, no matter how many javelin pieces of weaponry that they send in there, or the Thales Starstreak. No matter how they try to encourage this quagmire, I don't think it's going to go on for quite as long as they hope it will. So it may well backfire.
OK. Well, listen, thanks very much, both of you, David and Loki, for your illuminating insights. Unfortunately, we are out of time. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. We'll be back next week with more news and analysis. So until next time on Palestine Declassified, bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Nearly 2 years into the pandemic, it is clear that the coronavirus is not going to disappear anytime soon. Surges will happen, variants of concern will pop up, and mitigation strategies will need to evolve. Yet too many Americans are still paralyzed with doubt and fear over each new uncertainty, as trust in US government and other institutions to manage the virus ranges from shaky to non-existent. This opinion article has been written by the editorial board of the New York Times. The piece is titled, "We Can Live Better Lives While Being Smart About COVID." Nearly 2 years into the pandemic, it is clear that the coronavirus is not going to disappear anytime soon. Surges will happen, variants of concern will pop up, and mitigation strategies will need to evolve. Yet too many Americans are still paralyzed with doubt and fear over each new uncertainty, as trust in the US government and other institutions to manage the virus ranges from shaky to non-existent. It is past time to ask ourselves, as another COVID winter begins, if we have to keep living like this, anxious over the unknown, worried about large indoor gatherings, tense at every bit of virus news, and frustrated and at times contemptuous of fellow Americans who have a dramatically different sense of acceptable risk. Because progress has been made this year, vaccines that protect against serious illness and death are taking ever greater hold in the United States and are beginning to make their way into the world's most vulnerable regions. Drugs that work against the virus are coming through the pipeline, and despite a recent uptick in cases, schools and businesses remain open. Americans should pause a moment and let this progress sink in. The virus will continue to surprise us. And even when scientists manage to predict its worst turns, officials will not necessarily be able to prevent those turns from coming. But what if leaders at all levels made choices so that we don't have to exhaust ourselves with stress over every curveball? To help us all live more normally with this virus rather than let it control us. That exhaustion has characterized so much of the past 2 years, as parents, teachers, frontline healthcare workers, and small business owners wade through what can feel like an unending morass. Is it safe to celebrate the holidays? Will schools shut down again? When will young children finally be eligible for vaccines? And why are we still having to ask ourselves these questions? It is too soon to say how long the current surge will last or how it might be shaped by the Omicron variant. But even amid that uncertainty, we should push for a more pragmatic path from our decision makers that will help us protect ourselves and live more normal lives, even as the virus continues to evolve. make coronavirus testing as fast, easy, and inexpensive as possible. Ubiquitous testing could help schools stay open and make gatherings of every kind safer. With more than 1,000 people still dying of COVID-19 every day in the United States, it's past time to make this basic tool as readily available as it is in other countries like in South Korea or Britain. President Biden's latest plan, which would require people with private health insurance to submit a claim for reimbursement and people without health insurance or private coverage to hunt down free tests at community health centres, does not do nearly enough to achieve that goal. Instead, the Biden administration should do what other countries have done and what the United States did so successfully with vaccines. Work directly with companies to get more tests approved and on the market quickly. Use advanced purchasing agreements to ensure a steady supply of those tests and create federal subsidies for clinics and pharmacies to provide them free or very cheap to consumers who want them. Aim to make the 2021-2022 school year the last dominated by COVID. The Biden administration should have enough testing free and available and push to have a critical mass of students vaccinated by September. Quarantine and isolation policies will also need an upgrade. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, still advises people to isolate for 10 days after experiencing symptoms or testing positive, regardless of their vaccination status. Many schools still require anyone who's been in contact with an infected person to quarantine for several days, at least. As breakthrough infections become more common, even among those who have received their booster shots, it makes sense to allow workers and students to avoid confinement or test their way out of it much more quickly. Wearing face masks in schools is uniquely challenging. No one wants to force young children to wear face masks for several hours a day indefinitely, but it would also be foolish to abandon the practice completely. A happy medium may be to require face masks for students during surges or when new variants of concern are detected and vaccine escape is still being measured. The rest of the time, evidence so far suggests the requirement could be lifted. Nevada has successfully tied its school masking mandates to community transmission rates, and experts say it is worth trying the same in other states as well. We must all prepare for surges. No scientist or health official has managed to predict or even explain after the fact what constellation of forces causes the pandemic to ebb and flow around the globe the way it has. But it's clear that there will continue to be periods of substantial uptick in coronavirus cases, and there should be sensible, significantly better policies in place for dealing with them. Country-specific travel bans are futile. By the time a variant like Omicron is detected in one country, it's already spread halfway around the globe. Penalising countries that report new variants, as South Africa did with Omicron variant, will only discourage them from sharing that kind of information in the future. Blanket policies, like requiring everyone entering the United States to test negative or possibly quarantine, would be tougher and more expensive to carry out. It would also have a better chance of actually working. If federal officials are serious about using border control to slow the spread of dangerous pathogens, they will need to establish clear, enforceable test and quarantine protocols, not to mention adequate quarantine facilities at ports of entry. Do away with COVID theatre. The coronavirus is airborne, and any money spent on deep cleaning would be better put towards improved building ventilation. But instead of upgrading their HVAC systems, too many schools and businesses are still relying on things that won't work nearly as well. The plastic barriers that have become common in restaurants, Nail salons and offices, for example, can actually impede airflow and exacerbate viral spread. Lawmakers and local officials should make a concerted effort to change that. Not only would improved ventilation help thwart coronavirus, it would also curb the spread of other airborne pathogens, including the flu and those that cause the common cold. Keep going on vaccines. Public health powers were once a common feature of American life, when cholera and yellow fever routinely stalked the nation's major cities. Citizens accepted and expected their health departments to issue mandates, quarantine orders, and travel restrictions. It's crucial for officials to shore up those powers now, because scientists say the epidemics and pandemics will only become more common in the years ahead. President Biden's vaccine mandates have been bold and effective, and administration officials should stay the course no matter how many legal battles they encounter. In the meantime, government officials and private businesses would do well to stand firm on some basics. COVID vaccines should be required for public employees and in large companies, for healthcare workers, in schools, for staff, as well as for students for whom the vaccine shots are authorized, and for a range of indoor activities, including dining in restaurants and attending concerts. Face masks should be worn again in indoor public settings anytime transmission rates are high, vaccination rates are low, or new variants of concern are circulating. Even as we remain vigilant against the coronavirus, we need not remain in a state of paralyzing hypervigilance. Returning to the sound basics of public health, continuing the progress of medical innovation and ratcheting back the societal anxiety around the pandemic could make us all a lot healthier.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini al-Islami dini wal-Azam ghayru dini Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to be talking about the prayer rules according to the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hausa studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about the rules of prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. Sheikh Javid, I'm going to start this episode with this question. Is one allowed to start to pray behind a congregational prayer leader or imam that he or she doesn't have any kind of information about, and he or she doesn't know anything, like, for example, those qualities that you talked about in the previous episodes?
Well, it is very much important for a person to have knowledge of the imam and to know him, to understand that, you know, that he meets and fulfills certain requirements, one of which is justice. And if a person knows through any Sharia means, through any means, that the prayer leader is just and that he has an unblemished character, it is, you know, permissible to pray behind him, and the congregational prayer would be correct. Now, if a person does not actually know, and he has no information, nothing, and he cannot actually follow him, he cannot, you know, stand behind him and offer Jama'ah prayer.
Right.
So, you know, but you know, sometimes the face of the prayer leader, that the way he conducts himself, you know, shows that he is just, that he fulfills certain conditions. For example, if a prayer leader, you know, has beard and he's modest in his behavior, he is very much, you know, humble, he doesn't seem to be committing any sins, and in that case, of course, you know, and also there are other you know, circumstantial evidence that shows that he is, for example, just. when you, for example, when you see that there are a number of people, a number of believers, follow him during prayers. So this is a piece of evidence which simply indicates that the person is qualified for the leadership. Otherwise, other mu'minin would also have, they would not follow him. They would mm-hmm. not stand behind him.
I see. Yeah. Sheikh Javid, maybe for the sake of clarity, we need to define what justice is. All right? Because it's one of the frequently spoken, talked about or concepts in the world, but less defined.
Yes.
Would you please tell us and tell our audience about the meaning of justice in the opinion of Grand Ayatollah Khamenei?
Well, it is, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, it is a psychological state due to which a person always, enjoys piety, which prevents him from neglecting obligatory duties or actually doing things forbidden according to Islamic law. It is a kind of attribute that is ingrained in you mm-hmm. that makes you, act without act in the right way without even thinking. For example, you do not tell a lie, you do not backbite other people, you do not slander, you do not, violate other people's right. Because of that very psychological state, because of that very trait that is embedded in you, that quality that is embedded in you, which makes you do something in the right way and avoid things which are haram. And Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says that in order for you to recognize the state of justice, it is sufficient that you see the apparent goodness of the person. Mm-hmm. The apparent goodness of the person. Just as I said, if someone is apparently good, if someone actually conducts himself in a proper way, that is a sign of him being pious and right. just.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and discuss and continue our episode of Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about the rules of prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, can a person, one individual, pray behind a person who has the ability, for example, or the capacity to enjoin the good and forbid the evil, but does not?
You're right. Well, the mere abstention from enjoining people to do good
right.
and forbidding, them from evil, which in itself could be due to some reasons acceptable for the, for the people who has this duty to perform,
mm-hmm.
neither becomes a cause for invalidating the person's justice, nor does it become an obstacle for others to, perform prayer behind that person.
Mm-hmm.
So there are certain, probably problems, certain, observations that the individual might have, which is why he does not enjoin the good and does not forbid the bad. We do understand that enjoining the good and forbidding the evil depends on a number of, factors. And those factors must be available in order for enjoining to become obligatory. For example, if you know that your enjoining does not have any effect on the individual, And no matter if you forbid someone from doing something, from doing evil, it will not have any effect in the least on that individual. In that case, it's not obligatory on you to enjoin the good and forbid from evil. Though, of course, enjoining the good and forbidding evil, generally speaking, is obligatory. But it depends on the conditions and the circumstances. And, of course, we know the person who enjoins the good or forbids the evil, he better understands his own conditions or the conditions which he is in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we should not judge him. We should not pass any judgment about him when we see that he is not doing this. You know, there are certain reasons for not doing it.
Right.
And he has his own reason for not doing it. Otherwise, everybody likes to, you know, likes to advise other people to enjoin them to do good and forbid them from bad, because no one likes bad things. No one likes, you know, evil things.
Okay. Sheikh Javed, you know, sometimes it's too hard to find an apartment or a place of residence for one single individual. So people come together, like some youth, in fact, they live in a youth hostel and, you know, live together basically to share, for example, the, the accommodation fee, basically.
Yeah, they live in the same dorm, for example.
Yes, exactly. And probably some of them are students.
Yeah.
And that is normally the case. But they are not the students of religion, right?
Yeah.
Or they don't study religious studies. They only study at the university. Can one of these guys become the leader of a prayer and everybody else goes behind him and start praying?
Well, the Islamic Sharia does not say that the person leading the Jama'ah or the Friday, the congregation prayer must be, you know, a student of religion, or he must be a scholar, a religious scholar. No. If there are five people and one person chooses to lead the prayer, provided that he is, you know, he meets those five, six conditions, one of which is, you know, justice, it is quite permissible and it's quite recommended. And, of course, those five people will gain the sawab, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also very important that the person who leads the prayer, his pronunciation should be good. He should understand, you know, he should be able to recite and pronounce the letters and words correctly, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If someone's pronunciation is not good, it's not permissible to follow him during prayer.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javed.
Thank
you, dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iransat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.